6.
Gudit told me that a messenger had come that morning from the council house, which the Alds called the palace of the Gond, to say Auric Caspro was to wait upon the Gond before midday, not saying please or why or anything, of course. So they went, and so we waited. It was late enough when they came back that I'd had plenty of time to worry. I was out sitting on the edge of the dry basin of the Oracle Fountain in front of the house when I saw them coming along our street from the south, Auric afoot leading the horse, Chai the lion tamer beside him, and the lion padding along behind with a bored expression. I ran to meet them. "It went well, it went well," Auric said, and Chai said, "Well enough." Gudit was at the stable-yard gate to take Branty. Having horses in the stable was such joy to him, he wouldn't let anybody else look after them for a moment. And Chai said to me, "Come up with us, in the master's room." Though she hadn't yet changed her clothes or washed her face, she became dry again. I asked if they were hungry, but they said no. The Gond had given them food and drink. "Did they let you under the roof?" I asked. "Did they let Shatar in?" I didn't want to be curious about anything the Alds did, but I was. Nobody I knew had ever been inside the council house or the barracks, or seen how the Gond and the Alds lived there, for all of Council Hill was always guarded and swarming with soldiers. "Tell Mamere about it while I get out of these clothes," Gry said, and Auric told me, making a tale of it, he couldn't help it. The Alds had set up tents as well as barracks, tents of the fashion they use traveling in their deserts. The tent in Council Square was high and very large as a big house, all of red cloth with golden trimming and banners. "It appeared," said Auric, "that the Gond actually governed from this tent rather than from the council house, at least now that the rains had ceased. The tent would be sumptuously furnished and would have movable carved screens, making rooms of a kind within it. Auric had been made welcome in such great tents in his travels in Ossadar. But here he was not brought under even that cloth roof. He was invited to sit on a light folding stool, on a carpet not far from the open doorway of the tent. Branty had been taken to the stables by a groom who handled him as if he were made of glass. The lion tamer and the lion stood some yards behind Auric, with Ald officers guarding them. They, like Auric, were offered paper parasols to protect them from the sun. "I got one on account of Shatar," Gry called to us from the dressing room. "They respect lions, but they'll throw away the parasols because we used them, and we're unclean." They were offered refreshments at once, and a bowl of water was brought for Shatar. After they had waited about half an hour, the Gond emerged from the tent with a retinue of courtiers and officers. He greeted Auric most graciously, calling him Prince of Poets and welcoming him to Ossadar. "Ossadar," I burst out, "this is Ansul." Then I apologized for interrupting. "Where the Ald is the desert," Auric said mildly. I don't know whether they were his own words or an Ald saying. "The Gond Iaroth," he said, "was a man of 60 or more, splendidly dressed in robes of linen interwoven with gold thread in the fashion of Ossadar, with the wide peaked hat that only Ald noblemen can wear. His manners were affable, and his talk was shrewd and lively. He sat with Auric and conversed about poetry. At first they spoke of the great epics of Ossadar, but he also wanted to know about what he called the Western makers. His interest was real, his questions intelligent. He invited Auric to come regularly to the palace to recite from his own work and that of other makers. It would, he said, give him and his court much pleasure and instruction. He spoke as one prince to another, inviting, not ordering. Some of the courtiers and officers joined in the conversation after a while, and, like the Gond, showed a thorough knowledge of their own epics and a curiosity, even a hunger, to hear poetry and story. They complimented Auric, saying he was a fountain in the desert to them. Others were less friendly. The Gond's son, Idor, kept noticeably apart, paying no attention to the talk about poetry, standing inside the open tent with a group of priests and officers and chatting with them, until they grew so noisy that the Gond silenced them with a reproof. After that, Idor scowled and said nothing. The Gond asked that the lion be brought to him, so Chai obliged, and Shatar did her useful trick, as Oryk called it. Facing the Gond, she stretched out her front paws and bowed her head down between them, as cats do when they stretch, doing obeisance. This pleased everybody very much, and Shatar had to do it several times, which was fine with her, since she got a small treat each time, even though it was her fasting day. Idor came forward and wanted to play with her, dangling his feathered cap, which she ignored, and asking how strong she was. Did she kill live prey? Had she bitten people? Had she killed a man? And so on. Chai the lion tamer answered all his questions respectfully, and had Shatar do obeisance to him. But Shatar yawned at him after doing a rather perfunctory bow. "An unbeliever should not be permitted to keep a lion of Asudar," Idor said to his father, who replied, "But who will take the lion from the master of the lion?" Evidently a proverb, neatly applied. At that, Idor started to tease Shatar, provoking her by shouting and starting at her as if in attack. Shatar ignored him absolutely. The Gond, when he realized what his son was doing, stood up in a rage, told him he was shaming the hospitality of his house and offending the majesty of the lion, and ordered him to leave. "The majesty of the lion," Gry repeated, sitting down with us at last, her face clean, and dressed now in her silk shirt and trousers. "I like that. But I don't like what went on between the Gond and his son," Oryk said. "A snake's nest, as Gudit said. It will take careful treading. The Gond, though, he's a very interesting man." "He's the tyrant that ruined and enslaved us," I thought, but didn't say. "The Wailord is right," Oryk went on. "The Alds are camped in Ansul like soldiers on the march. They seem amazingly ignorant of how people live here, who they are, what they do. And the Gond is bored with ignorance. I think he's seen that he'll probably finish out his life here and might as well make the best of it. But on the other hand, the people of the city don't know anything about the Alds." "Why should we?" I said. I couldn't stop myself. "We say in the uplands, it takes a mouse to really know the cat," said Gry. "I don't want to know people who spit on my gods and call us unclean. I call them filth. Look, look at my lord. Look what they did to him. Do you think he was born with his hands broken?"
"Ah, Mimir,"
Gry said, and she reached out to me. But I pulled away. I said, "You can go to what they call their palace and eat their food if you like, and tell them your poetry. But I'd kill every Ald in Ansul if I could." Then I turned away and broke into tears, because I had ruined everything and didn't deserve their confidence. I tried to leave the room, but Oryk stopped me. "Mimir, listen," he said. "Listen. Forgive our ignorance. We are your guests. We ask your pardon." That brought me out of my stupid crying. I wiped my eyes and said, "I'm sorry. Sorry, sorry," Gry whispered, and I let her take my hand and sit down with me on the window seat. "We know so little. Of you, of your lord, of Ansul. But I know as you do that we were brought together here by more than chance."
"By Lero,"
I said. "By a horse and a lion."
"And Lero,"
she said.
"I will trust you, Mimir."
"I will trust you," I said to them both. "Tell us who you are, then. We need to know one another. Tell us who the Wailord is, or what he was before the Alds came. Was he the lord of the city?" "We didn't have any lords." I tried to pull myself together to answer properly, as I did when the Wailord asked me, "A little further, please, Mimir," I said. "We elected a council to govern the city. All the cities on the Ansul coast did. The citizens voted for the councillors, and the councils named the Wailords. Wailords traveled among the cities and arranged trade so that the towns and the cities got what they needed from each other, and they kept merchants from cheating and usury if they could. It's not a hereditary title, then? I shook my head. You were a Waylord for 10 years, and 10 more if your council named you again. Then somebody else took over. Anybody could be a Waylord. But you had to have money of your own, or from your city. You had to entertain the merchants and the factors and the other Waylords, and travel all the time. Even down into Sundraman, to talk with the silk merchants and the government there. It cost a lot. But Gavamond was a rich house then, and people of the city helped. It was an honor, a great honor, being a Waylord. So we still call him that. In honor. Although it means nothing now. I almost broke out in tears again. My weakness, my lack of control, scared me and made me angry, and the anger helped steady me. All that was before I was born. I only know it because people have told me, and I've read the histories. Then my breath went out of me, as if I had been hit in the stomach, and I sat paralyzed. The habit of my lifetime had hold of me. I should not speak of reading. I should never say to anyone outside my household that I had read something in a book. But Oryk and Gry, of course, didn't even notice. To them it was perfectly natural. They nodded. They asked me to go on. I wasn't sure what I should and should not tell them now. "People like me are called siege brats," I said. I pulled at my pale, fine, crinkly hair. I wanted them to know what I was, but I didn't want to speak of my mother being raped. You can see, when the Alds took the city, that was when... But we drove them out again, and kept them out almost a year. We can fight. We don't make wars, but we can fight. But then the new army came from Asudar, twice as many men, and broke into the city. And they took the Waylord to prison and wrecked Galvamond. They tore down the university and threw the books into the canals and the sea. They drowned people in the canals and stoned them to death and buried them alive. The Waylord's mother, Aleo Galva, she had lived in this room. She had been here when the soldiers broke into the house. I could not go on. We were all silent. Shatara paced by, lashing her tail. I reached out to her, to get away from what I'd been talking about, but she ignored me. Her mouth was half open, and she looked somehow more lionish than usual. "She'll be in a bad mood all night," Gry said. She got those rewards at the palace, and it reminded her that she hasn't had a meal. "What does she eat?" "Hapless goat, mostly," Oryk said. "Can she ever hunt?" "She doesn't really know how," Gry said. "Her mother would have taught her. Half-lions hunt in a clan like wolves. That's why she tolerates us. We're her family." Shatara made a long, groaning, growling, sing-song remark and paced down the long room again.
"Memer, if it isn't too hard for you to talk about it..."
Oryk began, and when I shook my head,
"You said they destroyed the library of the university? Entirely?"
I could tell he hoped I would deny it.
"The soldiers tried to tear down the library building, but it was stone and well built. So they broke the windows and wrecked the rooms and brought the books out. They didn't want to touch them. They made citizens carry them and load them on carts and haul them to the canal and dump them in. There were so many books they piled up on the bottom of the canal and began to choke it. So they made people cart them down to the harbor and unload the books and dump them off the piers. If they didn't sink right away, they pushed people in the water after them. Once I saw..." But this time I managed to stop myself before I said that I had seen a book that had been salvaged from the sea. It was in the secret room now, one of the northern scroll books, written on coated linen and rolled around wooden rods. The person who had found it cast up on the beach dried it out and brought it here. Though it had been weeks in the water, the beautiful writing could still be read. The Waylord showed it to me when he was working on it to restore the damaged text. But I could not talk about the books.
the old books or the rescued books in the secret room, not even to Gry and Auric. It was safe, I hoped, to talk about ancient times, and I said, "The university used to be here long ago in Galvamond." Auric asked, and I told him what I knew, mostly as I had heard it from the Waylord, of the four great households of the city of Ansul, Calm, Gelb, Galva, Octomo. From earliest times, they were the wealthiest families, with the most power in the council. They built the finest houses and temples, paid for public rites and festivals, and gathered artists and makers, scholars and philosophers, architects and musicians to live and work in their houses. That was when people began to call the city Ansul the Wise and Beautiful. The Galvas had always lived here on the first rise of the hill above the river and the harbor, in the Oracle House.
"There was an oracle here?" Auric asked.
I hesitated. I had given little thought to what the word meant until yesterday, the morning of the day Gry and Auric came, as I stood by the dry basin of the fountain, the Oracle Fountain. "I don't know," I said. I started to say more, and did not. It was strange. Why had I never wondered why Galvamond was called the Oracle House? I did not even know what the Oracle was, yet knew I must not speak of it. The way I knew, had always known, that I must not speak of the secret room. It was as if a hand was laid across my lips. I thought then of what the Waylord had said last night. "The hands of all the givers of dreams were on my mouth." That frightened me. They saw that I was confused and tongue-tied. Auric changed the subject, asking about the house, and soon got me to telling its story again. In those old days, the Galvas prospered, and both the house and the household grew, drawing to it people of art and learning and craft, and especially scholars and makers of poetry and tales. People came from all Ansul, and even from other lands to hear them, learn from them, work with them. So over the years, the university grew up here at Galvamond. All this back part of the house, both the upper and lower floors, had been apartments and classrooms and workrooms and libraries. There had been other buildings off the outer courts, and houses farther back on the hilltop had been hostels and domiciles for students and masters, workshops for artists and builders. The poet Denios came here from Uderley when he was a young man. Maybe he had studied in the gallery where we sat last night, for that had been part of the library of Galvamond. In the course of time, Luck, the god we call the Deaf One, turned away from the households of Calm, Gelb, and Octomo. As their wealth and well-being declined, their rivalry with Galva became rancorous. Partly in spite and envy, though they called it public spirit, they persuaded the council to claim the university and its library for the city, taking it away from Galvamond. The Galvas accepted the ruling of the council, though they warned that the old site was a sacred one, and the new site might not be so blessed. The city built new buildings for the university down nearer the harbor. Almost all the great library that had been gathered here over the centuries was moved there. And I told Gry and Auric what the Waylord had told me. When they began to take the books out of Galvamond, the Oracle Fountain in the forecourt began to fail. Little by little, as the books were taken out of the house, the water ceased to run. When they were done, it dried up entirely. It hasn't run for 200 years. They opened the new university with ceremonies and festivals, and students and scholars came, but it was never so famous, so much visited, as the old library of Galvamond. And then after 2 centuries, the desert people came and tore down the stones, dumped the books into the canals and the sea, buried them in the mud. Auric listened to my story with his head in his hands. "Nothing was left here at Galvamond?" Gry asked. "Some books," I said uncomfortably. "But when the siege was broken, the old soldiers came here right away, even before they went to the university, looking for that place they believe in. They tore out the wooden parts of the house and took the books, the furnishings. Whatever they found, they took. I was telling the truth, but I had a strong sense that Gry was aware that it wasn't the whole truth.
"This is terrible, terrible," Auric said, standing up. "I know the Alds think writing is an evil thing, but to destroy, to waste—"
He was grieved and upset beyond words. He strode off down the room and stood at the western windows, where over the roofs of Galvamond and the lower city, white Sewell floated on the mist above the straits. Gry went to Shatar and clipped the leash to her collar.
"Come on," she said softly to me. "She needs a walk."
"I'm sorry," I said, following her, despairing again at having so distressed Auric. Everything I said was wrong. It was a day without Ennu, without any blessing.
"Was it you that destroyed the books?"
"No, but I wish—"
"If wishes were horses," said Gry. "Tell me, is there anywhere I could let Shatar off the leash to run? She won't attack if I'm anywhere near her, but it's less worrisome to let her go where there aren't people around."
"The old park," I said, and we went there. It is just above and east of the house, a broad gully in the hillside over the river where the embankments divided into the four canals. Trees grow thick on the slopes of the old park. The Alds never go there. They don't like trees. Nobody much goes there except children hunting rabbits or quail to get a bit of meat for their family. I showed Gry what they call Denios's fountain, near the entrance, and Shatar had a long drink from the basin. There was not a soul about, and Gry let the lion off the leash. She bounded off, but not far, and kept coming back to us. Evidently, she didn't much like the trees either, and didn't want to go far into the thick, neglected undergrowth. She spent a long time sharpening her claws on one tree, then another, and sniffed exhaustively on the tracks of some creature all round a great thicket of brambles. The farthest she got from us was in pursuit of a butterfly, which led her leaping and batting at it down a steep, dark path. After she'd been out of sight around a bend for a while, Gry gave a little purring call. In a moment, the lion reappeared, loping up at us through the shadows. Gry touched Shatar's head, and she followed us as we started wandering slowly back up through the woods.
"What a wonderful gift," I said, "to be able to call animals to you."
"Depends on what you use it for," Gry said. "It certainly came in handy when we came down out of the uplands and had to make a living. I trained horses while Auric got his learning. I like that work. I admire the way the Alds train their horses. For them, beating your horse is worse than beating your wife." She gave a little snort.
"How could you stand living in Asudar so long? Didn't you get angry at them?"
"I didn't have the cause for anger you have," she said. "It was a little like living with wild animals. Predators. They're dangerous and not reasonable by our standards. They make life hard. I felt sorry for the old men." I said nothing. "They're like stallions or buck rabbits," she went on reflectively. "Never a moment they're not anxious about a rival male or a female getting loose. They're never free. They fill their world with enemies. But they're brave and keep their word and honor the guest. Like my people of the uplands. I liked them well enough. I couldn't get to know any women, though, because I was pretending to be a man and had to keep away from them. That was tiresome."
"I hate everything about them," I said. "I can't help it."
"Of course you can't help it. What you've told us, how could you see them except as hateful?"
"I don't want to see them any other way," I said.
I don't believe Gry ever didn't hear what people said, but sometimes she ignored it. She walked on a little, and then turned to me on the path with a sudden grin.
"Listen, Memer, why don't you come with us to the palace? Second groom. You make a fine boy. Fooled me completely. Would you like to? It's interesting. The Khan's a kind of king. How many chances do you get to meet a king? And you can hear Auric. He's going to tell them the cosmogonies. That could be risky.
They're so stuck on Oth being the one and only god. But the Gond was asking him for it yesterday. I only shook my head. I longed to hear Auric speak that poem, but not among a lot of Alds. I wouldn't say any more about how I hated them, but I certainly wasn't going to be polite and meek and slavish to them. After dinner the next day, though, Gry brought up the idea again. Evidently she had talked Auric into it, for he made no objection, and to my dismay, the Waylord didn't either. He asked how dangerous they thought it might be. When they both said they trusted the Ald's law of hospitality, he said only, "The hospitality they showed me wasn't of a kind I want Memer to know. But that our people and theirs know so little of one another, after so many years, that is shameful, for us as well as for them." He looked at me thoughtfully. "And Memer is a very quick learner." I wanted to protest, to say I refused to go anywhere near the Alds. I didn't want to learn anything from them or about them. But that would be willful ignorance, a thing the Waylord despised. And also it would sound like cowardice. If Auric and Gry were willing to risk going to the palace, how could I refuse? The idea was more frightening the more I thought about it. Yet I was curious about the palace, the Alds, as Auric and Gry talked about them. Everything had been the same in my life for so long that I'd wondered if it would always be the same. The housework, the market, the empty rooms of Galvamond, the secret room and its treasures of reading and learning, and the dark, strange part of it where I dared not go. No one to teach me anything new but my dear lord. No one but him to be with, to give my love to. Now, by the coming of two people, the house had come alive. The ancestors were awake, were listening. The souls, the shadows, and the guardians of Sill and Hearth. The one who looks both ways had opened the door. I knew that. I knew that our guests had come on the path of Ennu, and with Lero's blessing, and that to refuse what they offered me was to refuse the gift, the chance, the turning of the way.
"Do you want to go, Memer?"
the Waylord asked me. I knew if I protested he wouldn't insist. I shrugged, not even speaking, as if it were a matter of no importance to me if I went or not. He looked at me searchingly. Why did he agree to send me among our enemies? And I saw why. Because I could go where he could not. Even if I was a coward, I could carry his courage. He was asking me to play my part as the heir of our house. "Yes, I'll go," I said. That night, for the first time in my life, I dreamed of the man who was my father. He wore the blue cloak the soldiers wear. His hair was like mine, a dun, dull, crinkly mass too fine to comb. Sheep hair. I could not see his face. He was climbing, clambering hastily over ruins, broken walls and stones, such as our city was full of. I stood in the street watching him. As he passed, he looked straight at me. I could not see his face clearly, but I thought it was not a man's face, but a lion's. He looked away again and climbed over a ruined wall, hurrying, as if pursued.